Doherty stared at Angus for a long moment, then smiled slowly. Angus braced himself. Hey there, good and wonderful people. How are you? This is Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster here on the Mystery Hour. Thanks for tuning in to Sunsounds of Arizona. A real pleasure having you with me. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Marcel Dubé bring us our first story. It's called Of Stroganoff and Jerry Cans. Angus emerged from the trail across the gravel road from his 20-acre lot, limping slightly from the ache in his hip. The doc had said that walking was the best thing for his arthritis, but the doc looked like he was fresh out of high school. What the heck did he know? It didn't help that fall was creeping toward winter. Afternoons were still warmish, but there'd been frost this morning. "Hello!" Hand over his eyes to cut the glare of the mid-morning sun, Angus peered up the road to see Lizzie Bastine walking toward him, pushing her baby in his fancy stroller. It had three fat tires and a better suspension than his F-150. The stroller needed it on this road. Lizzie wore a plaid scarf and a bright red jacket against the cold. She stood out against the backdrop of black spruce and golden aspen on either side of the road that disappeared around the bend. Those aspen leaves were one stiff wind away from decorating the ground. He walked over to meet her, squaring his shoulders and controlling his limp. "There's no fool like an old fool," he told himself. It was pathetic the way she made him feel, but at 72, the attentions of a sweet young thing were not to be wasted. "Morning, Lizzie," he said with a smile as he approached. In the stroller, Joshua looked up at him suspiciously. Angus stuck his tongue out at him, and the boy grinned. At 10 months, that little boy was a better judge of character than most adults Angus knew. "We're just going for our constitutional," said Lizzie. "Care to join us?" She had bright hazel eyes and curly brown hair that caught the sun like liquid honey. He liked the way she had to look up at him, the way she always seemed to reserve a special smile for him. 40 years ago, he would have warmed her bed on a cold night. Hell, 20 years ago, he would have made a play for her, if she wasn't already married. He had done many things he wasn't proud of in his life, but he had never gone after a woman who was already taken. But he was pretty sure he could have persuaded her if he had tried. He wasn't particularly vain, but he was still straight-backed and tall, and he could still split a cord of wood in the morning. And he still had all his hair, well, even if it was white now. Lizzie and her husband Jeremy had moved in at the beginning of the summer, taking over the old Hanson place. All the women in the area had found an excuse to come visit when they heard about the baby. It hadn't taken Lizzie and Jeremy long to make friends with all the neighbors. Well, all except for Tom Doherty. No one was friends with that punk. It was just Lizzie and Jeremy's bad luck that their 20 acres abutted Doherty's. "Well, thanks," he finally said, "but I've got wood to split." He nodded toward his driveway across the road from the trailhead. Lizzie nodded. "Well, all right. Come for dinner on Tuesday. Jeremy will be back by then." Jeremy's job took him away a lot, so much that Angus had started keeping an eye on Lizzie and the boy. Angus grinned. "Are you making your stroganoff?" She smiled impishly, revealing a fleeting dimple. He was pretty sure the dimple had been his undoing. "I might." "I'll bring some wine," he promised. He leaned down to Joshua and poked him in the belly. The boy giggled, and satisfaction washed over Angus. He could make a pretty woman smile and a baby giggle. His life hadn't been wasted after all. The truck came around the curve so fast that all three looked around in alarm at the sound of spewing gravel. Angus barely had time to pull Lizzie down toward the baby stroller and cover both her and the boy before the pickup roared by them, throwing gravel onto his legs, back, and head. The boy started crying, and Angus straightened and stared after the pale blue and white Chevy Silverado. Through the back window, he saw Tom Doherty staring back at him in the rearview mirror. "It's all right," murmured Lizzie, and he turned to see her cradling Joshua in her arms. The boy was still crying in fright, and she rocked him gently to calm him down. It was only when she turned her head to look at him, eyes dark with alarm and anger, that he saw the trickle of blood emerging from her hairline and onto her forehead. "Oh, you got nicked," he said calmly, fishing through his pocket for a clean tissue and finding none. Finally, he pulled a baby wipe out of the baby's stroller and pressed it to her forehead. "There, keep pressure on that," he said, taking Joshua from her and strapping him back in his stroller. "I'll walk you back home." He made Lizzie a cup of sweet tea and set it next to the rocking chair she was in. Mother and son were shaken, but they would be all right. Angus wasn't sure he would be. She refused to let him call the police. "You were the police," she said, rocking the boy. "You know as well as I do there's not much they can do."
"There is if I press it," said Angus, his stubborn streak rising up. "That man's a menace. At the very least, they'll open a file on him."
Lizzie shrugged. "And I'll have made an enemy of a neighbor. Please don't report him, and don't tell Jeremy either," she warned. "Things will only escalate. I don't want him confronting the man."
"Fine," said Agnes.
He left her rocking her boy and whispering to him comfortingly. A confrontation was exactly what he wanted, but he wouldn't tell Jeremy, if that's what Lizzie wanted. He was willing to bet that Jeremy would figure something was up, especially when he saw the scab on Lizzie's forehead. She had confided a few days ago that she thought Doherty was growing weed on his lot from the way he smelled the few times she had encountered him on the trails. When she told him that, Angus's breath had almost stopped. It wasn't the weed. It was the thought of Doherty on the trails where Lizzie walked alone with a baby. It was the way her gaze slid away from Angus, as if she didn't want him to see the fear in her eyes. Weed explained a lot. The man had moved in a year ago and pretty much kept to himself until a few months ago. The activity had been building up around Doherty's lot all spring, with lumber and soil deliveries and visits from people who only stayed a few minutes. The man lived alone, and as far as Angus could tell, he didn't work. So how did he pay for the lot and the house on it? How did he pay for the food, gas, taxes, lumber? Angus could guess. He had always operated on a live-and-let-live basis, especially since retiring. But Doherty was taking up too much room, operating as if no one else lived around here, as if the road were his and his alone. Angus had seen Doherty's punk-ass type before. He would keep getting worse until someone stopped him. Instead of turning left toward his place when he left Lizzie's and Jeremy's long driveway, he turned right and headed up the road toward Doherty's lot. After all, he hadn't promised Lizzie he'd stay away from the man. The sun had melted all the frost and was shining through the space between the trees, lighting the motes of dust and placing dappled shadows on Doherty's driveway. Still too cold to take his jacket off. The Little Feathers family, who had owned the property before, had kept the place neat and well-maintained. Not so Doherty. As Angus approached the tiny two-bedroom house, the first thing he noted was the firewood piled haphazardly in the guy's front yard. At least 5 cords. Sam Little Feathers had built a couple of covered racks for his firewood, one near the front and one by the back door. He never had to dig through the snow to get firewood. Angus always judged a man by how well he stacked his wood.
He suspected most of the women in the neighborhood did, too. The smell of fresh-cut firewood reached him, and he breathed deeply, only then noticing the stink of gasoline. The Silverado was parked at the side of the little house. A month ago, Edna Drury had told him she believed Doherty had clipped her Samoyed, Yuri. She'd heard the yelp and run out to the road to see the back of Doherty's truck speeding down the road. Yuri, she found in the ditch covered in blood. He barely survived. Edna, bless her, confronted Doherty, who denied everything and told her to get off his land. And that wasn't the only incident. People in the subdivision had been grumbling for a few months about Doherty and his dangerous driving, his cavalier attitude toward their safety, his contempt for anyone who stood up to him. Not your regular run-of-the-mill bully. Savage barking brought him to a sudden stop, and he stared past the pile of wood in the direction of the house. Underneath the balcony was a doghouse, and a Rottweiler chained to one of the 4x4s supporting the balcony. The dog stood at attention, his chain taut, staring at Angus and barking wildly. So, Doherty had gotten himself a guard dog. Angus wondered what the dog was guarding. He hated seeing a chained-up animal, especially when the owner was at home. "Hey, pup," he said softly, skirting the pile of wood to approach the dog. He reached into his jacket pocket and pulled out a bag of dog treats. "Want a treat?" He opened the sealed foil bag, and the dog immediately sat down, watching his hands with interest. Angus walked to within a few feet of the dog and tossed the treats to him. "Here you go." The dog caught one in midair and immediately snuffled around for the others. "You always carry treats in your pockets?" Angus turned toward the voice, surprised that Doherty had managed to walk up so close without him hearing. Maybe he needed to get his ears checked. He nodded and tucked the treat back into his pocket. "Yeah, lots of dogs around here," he said. "Not all of them friendly." In the 15 years he had lived here, he had walked every property line in the subdivision. He knew where every kid's fort, junk pile, and abandoned car was on every lot. He knew every dog on the 26 lots in the subdivision, and more importantly, every dog knew him. Doherty nodded thoughtfully. "Yeah, there's probably a reason for that." He was a tall one. Not quite as tall as Angus's 6'2", even after shrinkage, but close. Heavy shoulders, muscular, judging by the forearms emerging from the pushed-up sweater sleeves. Lean. He wore faded jeans with dirt on the front, and his green sweater had twigs and broken bits of leaves stuck to it. He clutched a long screwdriver in one hand. Whether he'd been working on something, or just grabbed it when he heard someone out front, Angus couldn't tell. Doherty's hair was so short it was practically shaved, emphasizing the hard planes of his face. Angus wondered if there were tattoos hidden under that sweater, and if so, what they depicted. "Is there anything I can do for you?" asked Doherty, his green eyes narrowed slightly. "As a matter of fact," said Angus pleasantly, "yes. You hurt Lizzie Bastien when you roared by us on the road just now. One of the rocks hit her in the head, cutting her. I came to ask you to slow down, especially around the blind curves." Doherty stared at Angus for a long moment, then smiled slowly. Angus braced himself. "You're sweet on her," said Doherty, tucking the screwdriver tip into the back pocket of his jeans. "You're a little long in the tooth to hope to get into her pants. Can you even get it up anymore? Maybe it's a question of the spirit being willing, but the flesh being weak. Well, I can't say I blame you. She's one tasty little morsel." The smile turned lewd. Nasty. "Her husband's away a lot. I bet she gets lonely." They stared at each other, neither giving way. Angus's thoughts turned to all the ways he could kill Doherty before the younger man even knew what was happening, starting with shoving him so he fell back onto the screwdriver. Something in his eyes must have telegraphed his thoughts. Doherty's smile disappeared and his eyes grew cold.
"It's time for you to leave, old man."
Angus smiled slowly. "Time to leave." He spent the next few days watching Doherty's place. His visitors came after supper and never stayed long. Whenever Doherty left the place, Angus walked up to the house, usually from the driveway, but sometimes from the property line, to get the Rottweiler used to his presence. He always brought treats. After a couple of days, the dog let him pet him. He explored Doherty's 20 acres, mostly black spruce and aspen, but some lodgepole pine and birch, and finally found the greenhouses. Doherty had built them outside his property line on Crown land, as if that gave him plausible deniability. There were four of them, about 5 feet apart, with their doors facing each other. Angus didn't even need to go inside to know what Doherty was growing. The smell of cannabis surrounded the greenhouses like pungent clouds. He stared at the milky white poly sheeting that took the place of glass and marveled at the man's balls. A careful survey of the narrow field and surrounding trees showed no cameras, not even a wildlife motion camera. Talk about cocky. The greenhouses were all locked, which seemed ridiculous considering each one was wrapped in plastic. He had hung onto his tools and got the padlock off the first greenhouse in a few seconds. The moment he opened the door, the smell hit him like a slap in the face. The marijuana plants were taller than he was. Their buds were plump, and at least half of the tiny white hairs had darkened. Harvest time. He was willing to bet that somewhere in Doherty's basement was a cool, dark room with drying racks. He checked the other three greenhouses, all full of marijuana plants. Each greenhouse had a series of 50-gallon drums against one wall. He'd seen it before. They were filled with water. The sun heated the water during the day, and at night the water released its heat into the greenhouse, keeping it from freezing. And with the small wood stove at one end of each greenhouse, Doherty would be producing weed until November. Even though weed was now legal, it was illegal to grow it in these quantities unless you were a licensed grower, and no licensed grower would build his greenhouse on Crown land. Tom Doherty was in the illegal drug business. Angus locked everything up again and left, wiping down the locks and making sure to pat the Rottweiler before he went home. That night, the scent of sweet hay competed with the stink of gasoline as he carefully walked the property line between Lizzie's and Doherty's properties. His hiking boots crushed the blood-red fireweed that filled the narrow space. The day had given up its meager warmth the moment the sun went down. Now, at close to 2 a.m, he could see his breath in the light of the full moon. He was glad he had worn a sweater under his jacket. Oh, his hip twinged as he stepped on a stone, and the gasoline sloshed in the two jerry cans. The spade he had strapped to his back slapped his backside with every step. He had avoided this particular property line after Lizzie and Jeremy moved in. It wasn't rational, and he knew it, but it would have felt too much like he was stalking her, especially as their quirky little house wasn't that far from the line. As he passed where he judged Doherty's house to be, he briefly considered cutting through the woods to alert the dog to his presence and give him a treat. And then he decided against it. He couldn't afford to have Doherty find him there. 10 minutes later, he caught a faint whiff of wood smoke and knew he was near. He finally emerged into the small, narrow clearing that held the greenhouses. They glowed in the moonlight like something that had just landed from space. A low growl was all the warning he got. The Rottweiler leapt at him only to stop short when he recognized Angus. "Hello, boy," said Angus softly. He set the jerry cans down and dug through his pockets for the treats. "Here you go." He walked up to the dog and held the treats out in the palm of his gloved hands. The dog inhaled them and sat back expectantly. Angus studied the chain tethering the dog. It ended at a short metal stake with a loop through which the chain was tied. The stake was just beyond the greenhouses, about halfway between them. The chain was long enough to allow the dog to reach anyone using the doors.
"Is this where you spend your nights?" he asked the dog.
"Son of a gun." He patted the dog again and looked at the collar to which the chain was attached. It was just a buckled collar.
"Okay," he said softly. "Let me finish, and I'll get you out of here."
It took longer than he had expected, but finally the jerry cans were empty. He set them in one of the greenhouses, knowing that they would melt in the fire. He had opened all four of the tiny wood stoves, and the flames, fed by a surplus of oxygen from the open doors, burned brightly. At any moment, the gasoline fumes would reach the fires. He wanted to be gone before that happened. He put the locks back on each of the doors and hurried over to the dog, who allowed him to unbuckle his collar.
"Come on, boy," said Angus, breaking into a jog in spite of his hip. "Let's get out of here."
The moment that gasoline caught, the fire would be seen for miles. Someone would call the volunteer fire department, who would call the police.
Let Doherty bully his way out of that one.
The dog trotted behind Angus, a dark shadow in the trees. After a few moments, Angus slowed down. It wouldn't be very smart to twist an ankle or break his leg. He heard the gunshot seconds before the first whoosh of the fire went up behind him. The Rottweiler whirled and half sat, half backed away from the fire in the night sky behind them. Angus just stood where he was, listening. Had there been a weapon hidden in the greenhouses? Had it gone off when the fire reached it? But the sound had come from Doherty's house. Had that punk shot somebody? He immediately plunged into the trees at an angle from the property line, the Rottweiler leading the way. Angus had no weapon with him except for a Leatherman, but he had to know what Doherty had done. Spruce branches whipped him in the face and body, and he almost ran into an aspen tree because he was too busy watching his feet to look around. He had a darn good sense of direction. Even at night, the house was nearby. The Rottweiler, maybe 15 feet ahead of him, suddenly stopped and began to growl. Angus hurried to the dog and placed a quieting hand on his head. He didn't want the dog pouncing on some poor wounded bugger. He strained to see past the trees and finally caught sight of what he had known would be there, the straight lines of Doherty's house and the sloping darkness of his roof. Beneath his hand, the Rottweiler tensed, and Angus's fingers curled in the scruff of the dog's neck, ready to try to hold him back if he had to. He wasn't sure he could. The fire at his back rose high above the trees, casting light alternating with dark shadows. The stink of burning plastic almost made him cough, but he controlled himself. Then he followed the dog's gaze and saw the figure standing still by an aspen tree. His hand reached for the Leatherman, even as he knew there wasn't a whole lot he could do with one. The figure moved, and suddenly Angus saw the blonde hair and realized who it was.
"Jeremy? What the hell was he doing here?"
"Hello, Angus," said Jeremy Bastien, coming closer. He closed his fist and put it out for the dog to stiff. When the Rottweiler didn't bite, Angus let go of him. He sat down watching.
"Was that a gunshot?"
asked Angus. He knew darn well it was, from a handgun, a big one.
"Yep," said Jeremy. He turned toward Doherty's house. "I think Doherty shot himself."
The wail of sirens sounded in the distance. The fire trucks would be there soon. Not that they would be able to get to the fire, not with their trucks anyway.
"How do you know?" asked Angus.
"I looked through the window on his deck. He's on the kitchen floor, a big hole in his head. His gun is on the floor next to him. Looks like suicide to me."
The two men stared at each other for the space of two heartbeats.
"How do you even know it's his gun?" Angus finally asked.
"He showed me last week," said Jeremy, his voice grim, "when I asked him to leave Lizzie alone."
So Jeremy had been aware.
Angus considered all the steps the investigators would take.
"You know, I've seen a lot of strangers coming and going from his place."
Don't ask him what he was doing there at this time of night, he warned himself. Just don't ask.
Jeremy nodded, placing his hands on his hips. Well, he said, I've heard rumors about drugs.
He glanced toward the fire.
Angus followed his gaze.
Wouldn't be the first time a drug deal led to a murder.
The sirens were closer now.
We should go, said Jeremy, turning away from the house and heading for the property line, best to avoid the driveway.
The two men didn't speak. Only the sirens growing closer and the dogs panting accompanied their silence. Finally, they reached the spot where Jeremy could cut across to his own place. They stopped and stood for a moment, listening. The fire truck was on the main road now, not much time.
You'd better go home and change, said Jeremy quietly. You smell like weed.
Angus nodded. And you better go home where you've been all night. Maybe burn your clothes? He thought a moment more. And give me your shoes.
My shoes? Why? Asked Jeremy, startled.
Because of shoe prints, thought Angus, and blood spatter. He was an old man and former law enforcement. They wouldn't search his house. They wouldn't find the suspiciously clean shoes he would leave in his closet. He just waited, and finally Jeremy leaned over, unlaced his shoes, and handed them to Angus.
And take a shower, said Angus. Lots of soap and shampoo. Lots of hot water.
Jeremy nodded and started to turn away, then stopped.
You still coming for dinner tomorrow night?
Gah, wouldn't miss Lissy's beef stroganoff for anything.
Jeremy clapped him on the shoulder before disappearing into the trees. Angus raised his arm to his face and sniffed.
Definitely stank of weed.
He reached the road and crossed it, the dog at his heels, just before the first fire truck reached the bend in the road.
All right, folks, I'm in the said same Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine. This time it's James Van Pelt that pens our story, entitled Mystery Movie. The Creep. Bought a ticket for the Friday night midnight movie 5 minutes before the trailer started. Long beige trench coat, beige fedora, dark pants and shoes. He wore the hat low and covered his eyes with black-rimmed sunglasses. How he could see through them at midnight was beyond me, and since he'd been coming for the last year, when I checked the theater on the half hour, he still wore them. The creep is not his name. We don't know who he is. But Louise started calling him that the first time he came in, and the tag stuck. I'm glad to see him, though. After last week's murder. No concession stand for the creep. He strode down the hallway to the theater with his hands in his pockets. Eloise, the cashier, said, I'll bet he drives a van filled with candy for little kids. I pushed the sweeper under her stool. It's amazing how many tiny dandruffy scraps accumulate from tearing the tickets.
He makes eclectic choices in movies. Porky's last week, Napoleon this week. I thought I was the only one in town who liked black-and-white French films from the 20s.
Eloise shrugged.
Yeah, subtitles are an acquired taste.
She scooted around on her stool.
I can't get my son to watch an old film to save his life. No black-and-white, no subtitles, anything before 2000 is a waste for him.
Not even Star Wars? That's 77.
He says special effects are execrable. What sort of a 12-year-old am I raising?
I'd met her son a couple of weeks ago when she invited me to dinner at her house.
He was bookish, snooty, and full of himself. Could be I was seeing his worst side. No kid likes the man who's replacing Dad, even if the dad is doing 10 to 20 for armed robbery and used to beat Mom. We were very proper in the house. After he went to bed, Louise and I snuck into my car and made out for an hour. Dating in your middle age. We sold 65 tickets to Napoleon, way more than normal for this kind of flick. Probably a bunch of ghouls in there. The macabre attracts the certain sort. Like if there's a bad accident on the highway, most are afraid they'll see something awful, although they slow down. A few hope to see blood. The ghouls. High school and college kids came in groups. Some couples, a film buff with a notepad. An old film like this, small chance people try to record with their phones or more sophisticated cameras. Confrontations in the theater with a patron who has set up a tripod to steal the movie are never pleasant. They get noisy and ugly, like their $10 ticket gave them free access to appropriate someone else's creative effort. It's easier to call a cop, but management doesn't like me to do that, and the cops have better things to do with their time. Tonight, though, a cop was with us. Well, a detective. I wanted to comp him the ticket, but he insisted on paying. The midnight movie has its own worries. Pot and alcohol, mostly. The morning after we showed Reefer Madness, the theater smelled like a bad night at a rave. Coitus? Why teenagers can't use their parents' empty house from 3 to 5 every weekday afternoon while their folks are at work is a puzzle. And last week, murder. That's the last of them, said Louise. She slid the cover over the ticket port and latched it down. I'll prep for tomorrow. I found the body, of course. The guy sat near the front, turned on the lights, but he didn't move. excuse me, sir, movie's over. Drunk, stoned, or asleep, I figured. When I walked up in the row behind him, though, and shook him, I knew. The detective showed me the murder weapon later, an 18-inch long narrow metal rod, needle-sharp on one end. On the other, a flat plate the size of my hand welded to the arrangement so it looked like a giant tack. This is tailor-made for killing in a theater, the detective said. It takes strength to stab through the seat and the victim. With this, our murderer gets it started in the chair, then throws his hip into it. His body weight does the work. I'll bet several of your patrons witnessed the killing and didn't realize it. No stabbing motion. He stood, leaned into the thrust, and this guy was a deader. Anybody could have brought the weapon hidden in a coat. It was likely that the killing happened when the film ended. The credits were rolling with the house lights down. Our killer stood, like other people, might have started doing, and then made his fatal lunge. I watched the security tape several times. It rained last Friday, so many customers wore hats obscuring their faces. We only have one camera, and that's pointed at the ticket counter. Everyone who paid showed up there, including the creep, distinct in his fedora. My security camera is old. The light at night is bad, and making an identification from the tape would be, well, nearly impossible. No credit cards to track folks down since we're a cash-only operation. I slipped into the theater back row. The black-and-white film flickered on the screen. Shaky handheld camera shots, weird dream sequences, overlays, and tight close-ups marked Napoleon. No dialogue, of course, just the orchestral soundtrack. Nobody sat in the murder row, which we'd roped off. I thought about unbolting the death seat, but decided the empty space would be more disturbing. The creep sat close to the back. The rest of the audience spread themselves evenly. Theater 6 is one of our two small screens, holding 240. Lots of empty seats, lit only by the 1920s movie. I set up Napoleon on the 35mm.
You can see the flicker if you pay attention, and in the music's quiet time, hear the old machine clicking in the projection booth. The detective also sat near the back, on the other side from the creep. I love movies, but tonight I focused on the people. The detective must believe the killer might return. What would the detective look for? Would folks sitting by themselves be the likely suspects? 15 people sat alone. Most of the time, singletons put an empty chair between them and someone else. The creep was alone, for example, as was the detective and myself. The guy who'd been killed last week was by himself. In the back row, no one could get behind me. I thought about that. Of course, in the back row, no one could see me either. The killer could walk up, kill me, and no one would be the wiser. It made me mad. The theater's where I relaxed. It's my ocean shore, my leafy forest, my safe place. And he took that from me. Theaters smell of popcorn. There was no way around that, but what's under that smell tells you a lot about the place. I kept a clean house. I smelled plush cleaner we used on the chairs every week, and the lavender spray we hit the restrooms with. Someone always smokes in them, so no matter what the sign says. There was a whiff of bleach, too, that I'd used under the murder chair, or maybe I imagined it. The papers covered the murder. Jackson Beck was the dead guy, father of two, a soccer coach, owned 3 gas stations. Middle class, no enemies they could find. He went to the movie because his wife took the kids to visit their grandma. As far as authorities could tell, he was a random victim. Anyone in my theater could have died. On the screen, Napoleon dreamed. There's European maps, lines of attack, marching soldiers. He's going to win the world. What if the killer had already struck? One of those motionless heads sitting in front of me could be pinned against his chair, heart stilled. I at least could check. I unslung my flashlight. It had a long red cone at the end to mute it. Normally, I shined it down the rows, checking for bottles. Everyone was still alive. The detective nodded as I passed. When I headed to the theater's rear, the creep put something into his coat. It was a tiny gesture, hardly noticeable, but he looked sneaky. I opened the door into the hallway, then closed it without leaving. Quietly, with my light off, I took a seat behind the creep. What was he hiding? I slouched down. He'd have to turn completely around and look directly at me to see me. A minute later, he glanced to both sides. I pushed up to look over his shoulder. From his coat, he removed what looked like a golf ball mounted on a straw. He pushed a button, and the ball glowed for a second. Something in his ear glowed, too. An earbud? I rose silently, moved from my row to his, sat beside him. The device vanished into his coat as I approached. "Recording a movie is illegal pirating," I whispered. He leaned forward as if to leave. "A cop is sitting in the back row. If I signal, you'll be answering his questions, not mine." The creep slid back in his chair. His voice rumbled a half octave lower than anyone I'd ever heard. "It would be unfortunate to attract authority." I'd never been this close to the creep. He smelled a bit like ammonia. "I am not recording your cinema," he said. "So what's the little ball and stick thing you used a minute ago?" He twisted to face me. In darkened theater, his face became all sunglasses and dark shadow. The film reflected from his lenses. "I will not return here. My work must be unknown." This was new territory for me. I dealt with people who snuck into movies, folks with obnoxious cell phone habits, loud talkers, gropers, false IDs, parents with screaming babies. What sort of person brings an infant to Fast and Furious? But not this. He was tense, though, really scared. "If you tell me what's going on, I'll consider it. Otherwise, that cop will be all over you." "You won't believe me." "Here's the deal about loving movies. Suspension of disbelief.
The only way to enjoy a movie, at least on the level that the filmmakers intend, is you check your critical apparatus at the door. If you know you're just watching moving lights on the screen, and the people you see aren't who they claim to be, and the dialogue is written for them, well, then you will never enjoy the film. You know how I can tell who has suspension of disbelief? I watch the horror films. When a hand shoots from the grave in the first Carrie, or a head pops from a hole in a sunken boat in Jaws, or an angry slime creature pushes its way out of the chest in Aliens, the people who have suspension of disbelief scream. They can't help themselves. They're frightened. The ones who don't laugh. They think the screaming is funny. It's not, though. The screamers know what movies are for. If you're not feeling it, your imagination isn't working. You don't find comedies funny. Tragedies don't make you sad. Sex scenes aren't arousing. And your heart doesn't race during a thriller. Not being able to suspend disbelief is a handicapping condition. I feel sorry for people who can't do it.
"Try me," I said. "I'm a champion believer." He didn't speak for a long time, but I could afford the patience. Napoleon is over 4 hours long. Finally, he said, "You would say that I'm a movie maker. So you were pirating the film?" "No, no." He leaned closer. "I'm recording the audience."
"You're filming the people?"
He shook his head. "No, recording them. This will be the part where you don't believe me. My instrument records people's emotional experience for later playback. The distance between the person being recorded and my instrument is crucial, and the recording is better if it's candid. So the theater is a perfect venue. I focus, calibrate, and capture experiences perfectly. Once I edit the raw information, I can play it back for an audience."
The nice thing about working in the theater is that you get used to dealing with all kinds of people. Most folks are normal, more or less. They are socially appropriate. Sometimes folks with real problems come in. They talk to themselves or to the screen. They lay on the floor in all that sticky pop residue to sleep. They're crazy and need help, or maybe they're just rude. All up in your face about the price of raisinettes or the sound volume. You get so you can tell who is off their rocker after a while, and the creep didn't sound off.
Nobody has that technology.
Not yet, they don't.
So what are you, an inventor?
I would say I'm an auteur of the human soul.
This will go quicker if I just call the detective over.
He took the headset from his jacket pocket.
"You'll understand if you try this for a minute."
He handed the lightweight headphones to me, an expensive wireless pair.
"Put them on, close your eyes, and relax. It'll take 10 seconds to engage."
A guy a couple of rows up turned around and gave us the evil eye. I knew his aggravation, and it embarrassed me. A movie, when it's good, is an uninterrupted dream. Someone talking or texting or chewing ice even breaks the mood. I put the headphones on. The creep might be a nutter, but he was an interesting one. Then I transitioned. It wasn't abrupt, not like a jolt, but I slid from my head to another one. In this other head, Porky's played on the screen. I think about how this is a horrible movie to bring a date to. It's supposed to be a comedy, but there's nudity, lots of it, and crude jokes. What is Kelsey thinking? Oh, I'll slink away. She'll never talk to me again. When her parents find out, they'll tell me she can't see me. Oh, man. Did they say what I think they just said on the screen? Oh, maybe I can apologize. I lean toward her. Then she's kissing me, her lips on mine. This is impossible. She holds my arm. Should I open my eyes? Her eyes aren't open. She breathes hard on my cheek, so warm her hand moves to my chest. I snatch the headphones off.
"Neat trick," I said, breathing hard. He whispered, "Not a trick. I recorded that last week." It's kind of sweet from his side, actually.
I can give you her point of view if you'd like to experience it. Totally different. She's predatory. She's planning on teaching him things. How'd you do that? It's the future of narrative. Complete immersion storytelling that will replace movie theaters. I edit the recording. Strip out specifics, replace personality with my creations, mix threads. In the last year, in your little emotional hothouse, I've collected thousands of hours of raw material. Wait a minute, you record everybody? That's why I do the midnight movie, Light Attendance. And you were here last week. You recorded the murder. He scrunched down. I thought he wasn't going to talk anymore. If he did record the murder, though, we could catch the person. Whoever it was sick. The murder weapon showed pure premeditation. You don't do that kind of crime just once. You get a taste for it. The creep whispered. I couldn't say anything. I didn't even know I possessed it until the next day when I saw the news. You could have called the police anonymously. I thought about the 2 days they closed the theater, how nervous we were when we opened Monday. Louise and I talked on Sunday over dinner. The movies were where we went to escape. The theater's darkness comforted us. But even now, knowing a detective was in the room, I didn't feel safe. I might never take a middle seat again. Only the last row protected my back. He looked at me from behind his sunglasses. I don't have a name or a picture. What would I say? The man you want is empty inside. You'll recognize him by the blankness of his thoughts, of how he only feels when he thinks about what he is going to do. And then he becomes sparkly, like a disco ball. He breathes hard, his hands and face tingle. When he takes the weapon out, when he places it, sirens swell in his head. He can hardly stand, but he does, and when he makes his killing blow, a flood releases inside him. Do you think a sketch artist would be able to use that? Is he in the theater now? Yes, but what can I do? I have no evidence. You have the recording. Irritated, the guy in front of us turned around again. I can't share that. The technology isn't ready to be revealed. It wouldn't be admissible in court, and even if it was, it would be pretty obviously an unreasonable search, wouldn't you say? I record people. I can't interfere. The art is a higher calling. Do you know what he's feeling now? No. No one does who isn't also a psychopath, but I do. Nothing reveals the human condition like this. Narrative broadens our experiences. Through it, we live vicariously, we emphasize. I'm revolutionizing storytelling. Eventually, people will see me as this generation's Martin Scorsese. I'm Fellini. You have delusions of grandeur. I scanned the auditorium. Everyone settled in, but one of them was a killer. Tell me who it is, or I'm calling the detective on you. He'll search you, find your equipment. He knows you were here last week. Whatever secrets you have, you can bet he'll discover them. The creep's mouth tightened. You know movies. He gestured toward the screen. Surely you see a glimmer of what I'm doing. I'm getting the detective. I started to get up. He put his hand on my arm. It's that one. He pointed to a figure 2 rows up, sitting by himself on the aisle. He'll be passive when they take him. Like I said, he's empty. I got up, kept my eyes on the man. His hands were in his lap. Ordinary, sort of middle-aged-looking frumpy guy. The detective didn't ask me how I knew. He moved down the aisle, marched the guy out. I looked back towards the creep, but he was gone. He must have taken off as soon as I stood. Later, before everything shook out, I thought I'd been stupid. All the murderer would do was proclaim his innocence. There would be no evidence. But a notebook in his pocket, filled with notes and diagrams, gave them enough to search his house, where they found 3 more super tacks. If this were a movie, it would be pure horror or a thriller. I can see how it would be shot, dark and moody, a noir palette. The music would be minor key with disharmonics blended in. You know the beginning of The Exorcist with its disturbing soundtrack? They recorded Howling Dogs, reversed the sound, and mixed it in. That's the kind of music our movie would have. The psychopath, who'd we'd only have seen in silhouette or just as a shadow crossing behind the scene, would stalk the theater rows. Who would he choose? Would it be the single mom, the high school sports hero alone at the movie, the sensitive poet looking for inspiration? We'd see the glint of his terrible weapon. Music would swell. It would be that kind of a movie. It's not the movie I'm in, though. After the detective left with the suspect, I couldn't leave my screen six. Napoleon is a long story. There were 3 hours left. The people who remained didn't know what happened and why a man was taken from the room. They didn't know about the creep and his marvelous machine. I asked Louise to watch the film to the end with me. She held my hand. I wondered what the creep would record from my head. Here's a human emotion that film and literature has tried to recreate, falling in love. How do you communicate what it feels like when you realize another life is entering your own? I'll tell you one thing. If it was like what was in my head, it would be confusing. Falling in love is about letting go and being afraid to let go. Well, at least it is for me. You know what else falling in love is about? It's about not knowing Louise's thoughts, not really knowing. Maybe the creep was wrong about the purpose of art. Total realism would be a mistake. Movies are movies, like impressionistic painting. Life, well, life is about not really knowing what's going on in someone else's head. Movies go through my filter. I'm part of making the movie work. It's participatory. What the creep offered takes the audience out of the picture. It's a bad idea. Those were the good thoughts while watching Napoleon roll on. But 15 minutes before the end, the guy in the row behind me stood up. I saw him from the corner of my eye. He made his way behind my seat and left the auditorium. Who leaves a 4-hour film that close to the end? And then he returned, sidling down the row, avoiding knees. As he came closer, my back itched. Movies are my life. Every fine memory is connected to movies. But now, as a man in the dark moved toward me, all I thought about was how easy it would be for a killer to push his spike through the theater chair. How, the other night, the poor man who'd only come to watch a movie never had a chance. He bumped the seat next to me and then passed behind, a frozen aura, and I held my breath. So, would you want to listen in to a presentation recorded by that machine? All right, in the few minutes we've got left, why break a good string? I'm going to stay with the same Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine, and we're going to do the story that won. The magazine has published a picture. Some of the readers have sent in stories about it, and this is the one that won. The picture is a pile of black trash bags piled up by the curb with a lovely spray of flowers resting on top of them. The story is by Carol Ottolenghi and it's called The Groom Got Cold Feet. My wedding was perfect. Of course, it wasn't actually my wedding. It was my best friend's. At my venue, graced by my decorations in my designer dress, and with my groom. It started 3 weeks before my would-have-been wedding was scheduled. Well, it evidently hadn't all started then, but that's when I found out about it. Mark asked for a little time away from wedding plans. I agreed and thought nothing more about it until 32 minutes later, my best friend Janine called. Evidently, Mark had left a lot of things out when he spoke to me. Janine thanked me for being so gracious. But I am gracious. Mark and Janine reimbursed me, and the wedding went forward almost as planned. My string quartet, my centerpieces, my specially curated menu to accommodate Mark's severe peanut allergy. I even perfected the flowers. The dethorned rose stems looked, very dull, oiling them liberally with the peanut oil that I had just happened to buy the day before fixed that. Oh, the flames from the church's 40 candles, 10 for each year that Mark and I had been engaged, danced with subtle beauty off the glistening stems. The banquet was perfect until Mark stopped breathing. After the EMTs left with him, I stayed to help clean up. I considered keeping some of the flowers because they were so lovely, but decided that no one needed reminders of that tragic day. Janine let me organize the funeral. It was perfect. All right, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler here saying, thank you so much for joining me, and would you please tune in again next time? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.